This week's podcast does contain swearing, almost immediately, in fact, so I would switch off if that's going to be a problem. And it may be that the rest of the podcast doesn't actually contain swearing, it's all just in this bit about the swearing. Because last week I said, oh, there's no swearing in the podcast apart from one use of the S word. And then it was correctly pointed out to me by several people on Twitter that I had overlooked some fucking. And that's not cool. You know, if I was on the radio, if I was on BBC Six Music still, that would lead to more than a stern chat after the show. It would probably result in the castle crumbling even further into the ground, in fact. But luckily, this is a podcast, and I can do what the fuck I want. Here we go.
I added one more podcast to the giant podcast bin. Now you have plucked that podcast out and started listening. I took my microphone and found some human folk. Then I recorded all the noises while we spoke. My name is Adam Buxton, I'm a man. I want you to enjoy this, that's the plan.
Hey, how you doing? Adam Buxton here. Welcome to podcast number 6, which features several conversations with an old friend, Garth Jennings. Now, if you used to listen to the BBC Six Music Show with myself and Joe, then you'll already know Garth, probably. He used to fill in for Joe every now and again when Joe was off doing his film things. And Garth was also a guest on my Big Mixtape show. He's one of those people a bit like Louis that I'm very lucky to have as a friend and helps me out whenever he can with this kind of stuff. And it's always nice to see him and good to talk to him. For those of you not familiar with Garth, let me tell you that he is a film director. When I first met him back in 1999, what a year that was! The explosion on the moon sent it out of Earth's orbit and it went spinning off with Martin Landau and Barbara Bain. But elsewhere, myself and Joe were preparing to make another series of The Adam and Joe Show for Channel 4, and we met up with Garth. We were hooked up with Garth by our then producer, Fenton Bailey. And Garth was then working on music videos with his company Hammer and Tongs, himself and his producer Nick Goldsmith and friend Dominic Leung, and they made some amazing music videos. One of the first ones I saw of theirs was the one for Coffee and TV by Blur. You know, the one with the little milk carton. And since that, which I believe is now in the Museum of Modern Art in New York, they have an exhibit there about the art of music video, and Garth's video for Coffee and TV is included therein. That's how good it is. And that's just the tip of the music video iceberg for Garth. He's done loads. He's done loads of really, really good ones. That's my considered critique. But he now works more or less exclusively in the world of feature films. Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy was his first foray into features in 2005. And he followed that up with a very different, much more personal and authored film, Son of Rambo, in 2007, which I was in, playing an angry teacher. I was brilliant. After Son of Rambo, Garth kind of wandered in the creative wilderness for a while, trying to figure out what his next move was going to be. I don't think he would resent me saying that. But for the last, well, nearly 5 years, he's been working on a very big studio project, which he talks a little bit more about in our conversation. He's also written a book, a children's book, called The Deadly Seven, which we don't actually speak about, but it's really good. If you've got young children, I would say, some, you know, aged between about 6 and 11 or something, they would really enjoy it. I highly recommend it. I'm going to do an audio book of it, actually. That's one of the things that I'm trying to do at the moment in my nutty room. But anyway, over the weekend, Garth and his family came to stay, and we found some time to record a couple of conversations for the podcast. We talked about how things were progressing with his film, an animated film that he is making, and we chatted about some of our favourite moments from other animated films, well, mainly Toy Story and its sequels. We also had a couple of conversations on the way to the pub. One about the danger of getting together with other people's families, including an anecdote about a run-in that Garth once had with his father-in-law, very enjoyable. And another conversation, which actually might be useful for someone, about how to get into an exciting industry that you have no connections to. A lot of people approach Garth asking for advice for how to get started in films. People even ask me for advice sometimes, and I always find it hard to know what to say. Often it just comes down to a question of attitude, so Garth and myself talk about that. Anyway, here we go. It's quite a long podcast this week. In fact, it might even be the longest one so far. So perhaps you can enjoy it in several sittings. As I so often say to Santa, why don't we have a jingle? Hey man, how are you?
I'm pretty great actually. I've got a nice glass of wine here. You've got your beer.
Sure.
Very cozy. There's something nice about being in a room that's soundproofed as well. It does make it even cozier, doesn't it?
It does, doesn't
it? It's all safe and cozy.
So you're here for the weekend.
Yeah. We've been coming to stay with you for probably, what, 10 years?
I guess.
On and off, at least twice a year.
Right.
We do a little Buxton retreat. Because you live in the countryside. And for us townies, this is as good as it gets.
Mm. And now you're not even an English townie anymore.
No, I'm a French townie. I live in Paris right now. We moved there 2.5 years ago because I am writing and directing a film for Universal Studios. It's an animated film with the company Illumination, who made things like Despicable Me and The Minions.
Oh,
and
been doing well for themselves.
They're doing okay, aren't they? And so the team that made that asked me to write a film for them. We met 4 years ago. I met the head of the company just for a cup of tea, literally just a cup of tea and talk about ideas. And after that, I said, oh, we had this chat about a certain subject. And I was like, let me write you a little sort of synopsis, an outline, see if there's any mileage in it. Very informal. So I wrote a few pages up for an idea and we sort of shared it and giggled about it. And then I said, all right, do you want me to write a script? And he says, yeah, let's write a script. So I wrote a script and then I did another draft. And by the time I got to the second draft, he said, would you be up for moving to Paris where the animation studios are and, you know, take your family with you and come and direct the film? And my wife had said to me before that meeting, because she has an ESP thing, she said, if he asks you to make this, just say yes and we'll just do it and see what happens. So I said yes, right there on the spot, and then phoned Wazza after the meeting. Went, he asked us to move to Paris. We could actually do this.
Wazza is your wife.
Wazza is my wife, my lady wife,
Louise.
Louise, yeah, everyone knows her as Wazza. Yeah. It's a long story why that name is there, but anyway, Wazza said do it, and then he asked me to do it, so I said yes, and then a few months later we moved, and it's been 2.5 years now since we've been living there.
That's an upheaval though. How many children have you got?
I've got four sons and
four,
yeah,
and they at the time you left were aged between about 2 and,
yeah, one was
12
two.
Or something.
Actually, we moved on the 2-year-old's birthday, so he was 3 the day we moved. On the day we moved. And oh, so what, because now they're 12, 10, 8 and 5. It was a massive amount of naivety in terms of, you know, we just thought, oh, this will be great.
Yeah.
No problem. You know, they're young and we'll learn to speak French and all that stuff. And you don't realise till you do something as big as that just how much you take for granted in your own life. Just knowing where to get milk from, or what time things are open, or when something needs fixing, which it does when you move into a new place with no furniture.
Yeah.
How much you need to work out. And starting new schools, I just didn't realise. I didn't take into consideration just what a big upheaval that was. Also, then your children going, wait, so you've taken me away from all my lovely friends to a place where I don't know anyone or what anyone's saying. So there was a lot of stress.
And didn't
beginning.
You think there was a good chance that they might actually deal quite badly with it and get a little bit depressed and antisocial?
Yeah, again, I didn't really think about that. Wazza as well was very, very pro the whole thing. Let's just do it. Let's have an adventure. She'd gone out and worked it all out because I was too busy just trying to make the thing work, the story work. So, yeah, we turned up in Paris and this lovely place, a lovely part of Paris, and it's just around the corner from the studios. The animation studios themselves are right around the corner from the Eiffel Tower. You know, you literally come out the building, turn left, and there's the Eiffel Tower.
So this is an American company, right?
Yeah, they're an American studio. Illumination is based in Santa Monica in California, yeah. Los Angeles. But all the animation, every bit of it, is done in Paris.
Why is that? Because they're just using French animators as sweatshop guys.
It's not. There's no sweatshop aspect to it. It's. I think there's a couple of things, or probably a few things, and I'm sure the boss could answer this better than me, but he wanted to set up his own animation studio, and he knew trying to set one up in Los Angeles would be very difficult because you've already got Disney and you've got Pixar up the road and DreamWorks, and all these people have already covered it. So it's very hard to find a new team when everyone else has, all these other studios have absorbed pretty much all the talent in the area.
Right.
In the country. So he was looking outside of America to find somewhere and met with companies in England, I think, and met with companies in France, and just connected with this chap that ran a company called McGuff. And they didn't have many people there, and they tried to make a feature film, or maybe they had done. I don't really know the specifics, but they just clicked. So they put a sort of scrambled together a team of about 90 people to make Despicable Me. And they had some French animators, isn't it? The whole thing, all of the films are all done there. And oh. And they brought in an American director called Chris Renaud to work with Pierre Coffin, who's a French director, and the two of them sort of worked together to make that film, and then the team assembled around them. It's predominantly French, but there are a few American people, you know, a part of that team, but it's mainly French folk. It's now, the team there now is 720. It's huge. I mean, and again,
not all working on your film.
No, but I've got about, I mean, it's over 100 now. It's, I don't actually know. I actually have to take Polaroids of everyone that I'm working with, yeah, and get them to write their name. And I have a whole wall in my office that is just the people I'm working with. So I can try and memorize their names between meetings. I can just look at this wall and try and go, that's Pierre, that's Guillaume, that's Zeb, that's Pef. They all have weird names as well. They've like abbreviating their name. They're Zebe, you know, and I just try and memorize everybody.
Yeah.
You know, it's almost impossible.
And how long then does it take from starting work on an animated feature? This is going to be like a big sort of tentpole animated feature.
It is going to be a big one.
Christmas 2016?
Yeah, it's due for release. Now, the release dates can change sometimes, but it's technically...
That's what you're working towards.
Yeah, it's Christmas 2016.
Right.
21st of December, I think. And it's a big one.
And you can't really say too much about the plot or who's in it and stuff like that because you're in, you know, early stages of production still, I suppose.
Well, it's not early, actually. It's quite, we're quite far in.
Uh-huh.
You know, we'll be done in animation by the spring next year, and we'll have delivered the film by the end of September, I think, next year, or the beginning of September next year.
Yeah.
And we've recorded almost all the voices, quite a lot of the music. And we're flying through the animation right now. It's looking amazing. But I can't talk to you about the specifics yet until it's officially announced, which could be any day now.
Right.
It's weird. I mean, this is 4 years now since I met for that cup of tea. And to still be working on something where I can't talk to anyone about outside of the company about what I'm doing is quite odd.
But you've got sort of A-list Hollywood talent in there.
It's ridiculous. Yeah. It's really silly. And they're brilliant. They're amazing.
And how have you found it?
I've got you in there as well. I'm allowed to say that, aren't I?
Yeah.
You're in there.
Of course, I've got to be in there.
Dr. Buckles.
I've been in all your films, haven't I?
Yeah, I think pretty much. Yeah, no, because it's only been two so far. So that wasn't difficult.
I wangled my way in there.
Yeah, but you're in this one.
I've told my story before of the dreadful audition I did for Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Yeah, I still have a soft... I still love you even more for doing that.
For those of you who never heard me telling that story, the short version of it was that when I found out that Garth was going to direct, after years of being a wonderful music video director with the company Hammer and Tongs, Garth then started working on these features, and the first one was an adaptation of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. And this was one of the first people I knew who was doing a big mainstream feature, and I was pretty impressed / envious because I had it in my head then that I should be in films.
Yeah,
Dr. Buckles should be in films. That's what I should be doing.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I should, yeah.
Well, Garth's a really good friend of mine, so maybe I should be in that film. And I sort of would say it, and I was thinking, I don't want to be too cocky about it. I don't want to be like put pressure on Garth, because that's not cool, because we're friends. On the other hand, I do want to make sure that I'm in the film. So I would tease you almost every time that I saw you.
Pretty much. It did get to that point where I was like, all right,
there was one time I remember your reaction. It was like, it was the most tired laugh that I've ever heard. After one of my jokes, it was like,
withering.
Okay, we've done that one.
Yeah.
And you're not going to be in the film. But then you lined, and I really didn't expect it, you lined me up with an audition.
Yeah.
Find myself in front of Susie Figgis, one of the most powerful casting agents around.
Yeah.
And decided that the
and
best thing to
do... She's quite a handful as well. She's no shrinking violet.
No, she's intimidating.
Yeah.
And I turned up with a towel and a bathrobe, dressing gown.
Yeah, you were in a dressing gown.
Because I was auditioning for the part of Arthur Dent, which I really was not expecting or wanting, because I thought, well, obviously I'm not going to play the lead. All I wanted was like a few lines. And I just thought, damn it, this is Garth's way of ensuring that I definitely don't get this.
Absolutely
thing.
The opposite. I was like, right, come on, have a crack. Have a crack at this. Because most auditions, when you think about it, loads of people audition for things and they don't get them, but they make an impression.
Right.
And Susie's, if you're going to make an impression with anyone, Susie Figgis was the one to do it with.
Well, I did, didn't
you
I?
You certainly did.
I did. Because she said, all right, should we have a go at reading? You know, you go in, you sit down. And as I say, I've told this story before, but you go and you sit down and have a little chit chat for a little bit.
Yeah.
And then she goes, okay, well, let's have a go at this scene. So I'm like, okay, just give me 1 second. Reach into my rucksack and pull out a bathrobe and put it on. As I'm doing it, I'm sort of aware that it's not cool. And that it's...
From Susie?
Yeah, she's mainly looking at me like, what are you doing? You know, I just said, let's start reading the lines, and now you're reaching into your rucksack and putting on a bathrobe.
Mm-hmm.
And as I was doing it, I was thinking, this is weird, isn't it? Oh, I shouldn't be doing this. But then I thought, come on, be confident.
Follow through.
And so I put on the bathrobe. I do the audition to the best of my abilities. I thought, well, I won't be getting this, but, you know, I gave it a crack. And she said, I think she said something like, well, that was a little bit better than I expected. Or something like that.
A sort of like a poisoned compliment.
And then I said, I think maybe slightly encouraged by that, I said, it's probably a bit weird me having the bathrobe and the towel, I suppose. And then she said, put it this way, if you'd done that in LA, you wouldn't work again.
I don't agree with that.
And then Martin Freeman got it, and I thought, okay, fair enough. I was in Son of Rambo as a...
you were in Hitchhikers, though. You were one of the workers at
I was
the
a
end,
worker that...
Restoring Earth, too, to its proper state.
I pushed it down a plunger to make some mushrooms pop out of the ground.
Yeah, which just feels right.
Sure. And then...
I was like, just give him something.
Give
Christ.
Him something so just he stops making
Give him
those
that plunger.
Jokes.
Do something with the plunger. Can somebody just help?
But then you were nice enough to put me in Son of Rambo as a...
Now, that was a proper part.
A
Come
shouty
on.
Science teacher. That was perfect. One day, no waiting around, went in there, had great fun. I could do the scene. Yeah. You know, all it required was some shouting, which I can do.
You are... I don't know anyone better at shouting than you. You're the shouter.
Yeah, I love to shout. I'm an angry, gnomey little man. And that's what the part required.
It was a lot of fun, though, and it was great because you had to, at one point, have some scissors. You had to look as if you'd stuck some nail scissors or some hair clippers up your nose.
Yeah.
Because of the accident. You were very funny with that. And because then you gave us loads of different takes.
I had to pull them out.
Exactly, I had to pull them out. Now, of course, they weren't really up your nose. We had to put CG tips in. Mm. You know, we had to put computer-generated
tips. It's my favourite kind of tea. That's what they drink in post houses, isn't it?
I can't believe I set you up for that. CG tips. Now, you pull these out, these half pair of scissors, and then we had to put the tops on. But you gave me such a load of different reactions. You gave me horrified to a level I've never seen before. Like
I can do horrified.
Absolutely appalled. And then my favourite one, which you didn't use because it was too much, but it was so funny, was that so appalled that you were going to throw up. And you were doing that face that somebody does just before they actually, that sort of...
Yeah, which I think I probably just copied off Jim Carrey and Dumb and
Dumber. Yeah, but it was brilliant. So we had a.
I know. I gave you everything. I gave you my three faces,
and shouting
the three faces of Buckley's.
Buckley's, give me your three faces and some shouting. Go action!
Wow, that was like having Toast of London inside my nutty room. There. Have you watched Toast of London? Matt Berry.
Yeah, he's basically if I've had an argument with Wazza. Which isn't that often, to be honest. Or if there's a bit of tension, I'll go to that Matt Berry voice and start talking to her like that. Just that. So, because that, for some reason, just unlocks all anxiety.
Yeah, within seconds you
are. He did that thing where he was doing like a nature... He was doing voiceover on UK rowing. Did you see that one?
No.
Oh, he just did a voiceover for something like an old piece of footage of men... like the Oxford-Cambridge boat race, that was it. Mm-hmm. And he would talk about it and he would say, and this changed the face of UK rowing. And that, for some reason, made Wazza just fall about laughing. So all I used to say to him, you know, we should be cleaning our teeth or something, and I'd just go, hey, Waz, it's later, we should probably watch some UK rowing. And that would just get her in fits.
He's got one of the great voices.
It's the best voice ever.
Hello, I'm Douglas Renham. And I'm not a scientist, but I do have a better understanding of what space is than any scientist living today.
So we're walking to the pub,
yeah,
our local pub for lunch, and we've got all our children there up ahead. My brother is squadron leader.
I have to say, your brother's been essential, really, hasn't he?
Yeah, it's essential to have a brother who is mature, sensible, and single.
Yeah.
So it's a very specific set of skills that my brother has to, like, be good at his job and be a nice person and be popular with the children, but not such a well-rounded person that he'll attract a partner.
Well, maybe this is a good chance to set Dave up. You know, if anyone's looking for love out there...
Yeah.
And loves, I think he looks quite like you. So, you know, they've got a rough idea of what he looks like already.
Yes, he's younger than I am. Well, he's about 4 or 5 years younger than I am.
Yeah.
And he's like a bigger, taller version of me.
Yeah.
But he's an IT guy.
Yeah.
So there are some quite big chunks missing personality-wise.
Are you allowed to say that? He's only 3 feet ahead of us.
He can't hear. He's surrounded by bracken and
okay,
it insulates.
That's true.
It insulates him from insults.
A lot of people like that, though. They can fill in those gaps. I wonder if actually dates should be more like less about, you know, impressing people with what you can and can't, you know, what you can do, and more like, look,
here's what I need.
This is what I need.
Here's what's missing.
Here's what's missing. Right? How do you feel about plugging that?
Yeah.
And they could go, actually, I've got loads of that, so that'd be useful because I've got loads of that to spare. Like,
you're right, that's exactly what it should be. And instead, everyone focuses on what they have in common.
Yeah.
And, oh, what kind of music do you like? That's slightly different to the music that I like.
Yeah, no, it's all going the wrong way.
Like, I'm not going to be able to bear you.
Yeah, yeah.
If you're playing all that stuff, and what kind of movies? No. And actually, you're right, you should be going for someone totally opposite that you can actually stand to be with and explore in every conceivable way for however long you're together.
Yeah.
Just are say, you look, quite I'm, similar
go
to
on, go on,
your
sorry.
Partner to Louise?
To Louise.
Like she doesn't get too stressed out.
No,
this is how it seems from the outside.
It's absolutely how it's the truth. She
and
doesn't get
stressed. She's on a very even keel.
Yes.
And you are too, but
no,
every now
like
and again.
That. You've seen me pop.
I've seen the top hat go on.
Victorian dad, get to your rooms, I've had it. Yeah, yeah, no, she's remarkably laid back. Now, that can be infuriating at times, the whole thing about people's strengths being often being their weaknesses as well. Like, Waza will be so laid back that time doesn't really matter.
Right.
So she does no problem, you know, being late for a plane or, you know.
Oh, she doesn't get anxiety about that.
No, no problem at all. Whereas I'm very anxious when it comes to time. I don't know why.
How early are you going to get to an airport then?
This is my dad. I mean, you're supposed to
check in 2 hours before an international flight, right?
Yeah.
That's still the standard.
Yeah, but I've been 3 hours before.
Three?
I know. It's pathetic. And I get it from my dad, who has actually got worse, he would admit, as he's got older. He will have packed a week before he's going anywhere. He will leave. He'll say, if he's got a 12 o'clock flight or a train to catch, he'll be there at something like 9 or probably 8:30 just to be on the safe side. And it'll always be like, well, you know, there's going to be traffic that time of the day, he'll say. Or, you know, there's been a strike in some country and that could affect things. And I want to be prepared. And he likes to be there with his book and his cup of coffee. He likes to be there early, just sitting there waiting for it. I'm a bit more like that, but Waz is so laid back. She's the opposite. And actually, it's the perfect thing. If you're going to have a big family, you've got to roll with it and be better at sort of, you know, just sort of
there's
going
no
with the
way
flow
you,
a bit more.
Right, you can't control every single aspect. And you've got four male children.
Four males, yeah.
So that is mental.
It's ridiculous, yeah.
In a way, you're killing the world.
We are part of the reason.
You are draining the world's resources. However, in your favour, I would say that you're both nice people and you'll probably raise good members of society rather than deranged killers.
Yeah, I definitely think we've knocked all the killing off in the head. I think that's been extinguished, any chance of that. But no, they're a good bunch. But it's been a real wake-up for me because I come from a tiny family. Christmas for me was about 6 people. And that was enough. It didn't feel like we were missing out.
So it's just you and your sister?
It was me and my sister, and then Grandma and Grandpa would come round.
Yeah.
And that was it. And then I go to Waz's house, and Christmas Day was 22 people around the table.
What?
And prior to that, there'd been about 30. I'm not exaggerating, about 30 just cousins. Just they're everywhere.
Yeah.
Because Waz is the youngest of 5. So she's used to sort of a big noisy mess and people coming and going at different times. And I'm used to sort of things being on time and being nice and tidy. And as a film director, you're always trying to make everything work in the most economical way possible. So my day is spent sort of fussing over moments. And of course, family is the opposite of that. You come home and it's just a free-for-all.
So Christmas time is coming.
So Christmas time is coming, and we will actually go to my wife's parents for Christmas this year. It's a sort of tends to be an on and off thing.
Yeah.
And it's weird because I was one of those kids that I would always chat to your mum and dad.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? I was brought up to be, say hello to the mum and dad. So
confident, a confident little chap.
Well, not so much confident, but just like I was
a precocious little prick.
An annoying little bastard.
It
wasn't like hello, you know, it wasn't that. It was just, you know, I would say hello and how are you and all that sort of, and mums would go, oh, wasn't he nice?
Yeah.
So why can't he be a bit more like that, you know? It's all superficial really, but it was just that I was just told and taught to be that way. So I've never had a problem meeting other people's mums and dads. And in fact, most of the time, I quite like it. Like, I'm going to chat to your dad this afternoon. It'll be great.
Yeah.
But the one mum and dad I struggled with was my wife's mum and dad, her dad is quite, he's a lovely chap. I should start by saying he's a very, very nice man. When I first met him, though, just as we were walking down the path to their front door, I said, oh, what's your dad's name? And Waz, my wife, goes, oh, it's
Caligula.
He's Michael or Mike or whatever.
Yeah.
So I go, hello, Mike. And he shakes my hand and he looks furious.
He went for Mike.
Oh, because everyone calls him Mike.
Oh, okay.
Everyone, his wife, the milkman, everyone calls him Mike. Not me, apparently. I'm not allowed to call him Mike. He went into the next room and, according to Waz's sibling, said, he just called me Mike. And I had to call him Mr. Pring for 6 years. 6 years, and it's so hard.
So how did that filter back to you then, via Woz?
I think it was his... That's a really good question. I can't remember because it's 19 years ago.
Yeah.
But I think it was his... was his mum.
So you
said, I think it would be better if you called him Mr. Prince.
Right.
And Woz was mortified.
Michael's totally cool, but he was wondering if maybe you could drop the mic.
Yeah. Well, after 6 years, though...
Wreck the mic. Don't check the mic.
After 6 years, I remember being there for a birthday of his, and he came into the kitchen and he said... All right, well, seeing as I'm, whatever, let's say he was 70 or something. Uh-huh. So, 70 now, you could don't have to call me Mr. Prig anymore. You can call me Michael, but not Mike.
Did he say it with a twinkle in his eye?
Nope.
None twinkle.
No twinkle. Mm. And it was all funny because the trouble is you can't call someone Mr. Prig in a normal conversation. Like, you wouldn't say, oh, Mr. Prig, could you pass the salt?
Right.
It just is ridiculous. So you just avoid the name altogether. So it was a little bit tricky, and it's the only person I've ever had a, I'd say, proper lose my nut with, you know.
Things came to a boiling point.
Yeah, and there was this one holiday, we'd all gone away, and he can be a little bit heavy-handed, and what I noticed was that when I'd go back to their house for these Christmases, it didn't matter how old my wife's siblings were, or how professional they were. You know, there's doctors and surgeons and, you know, guy that runs a string of pubs. I mean, they're all really bright professional people, but you get them back around the table and it's like everyone goes back to being 10 years old again.
Uh-huh.
In terms of how they're seen around the table. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
That those relationships are forged pretty early on, and it's very hard to change the way you're perceived within your family.
Oh, God.
Do you know what I mean?
Completely. You don't get any respect.
No.
And
you could go to the moon. Your mum would still, you know, or someone in your family would still think you're an idiot.
Definitely.
You know, and that's fair enough. But it used to drive me mad because I come from a family where people would, you know, where we'd stand up for ourselves if there was a bit of a fight or something. Mm-hmm. Not a fight, but if somebody challenged you, you challenge the hell back. So, and I noticed her dad would say things, and no one would, you know, quite spiky things. He sort of would say things like, well, that's a stupid idea, or something to one of his children. And I'd think, whoa, that was a bit below the belt. And they would just quietly absorb that.
Yeah.
And so I don't know where I have this. It's the only time I get riled is in that sort of situation. I remember being on holiday and he made my wife cry because he said, he kept saying, well, I think your children's haircuts is ridiculous. And
they look like girls.
They look like girls. And... something else, and at one point she said something in return, and she'd use some word that provoked this response. That's a big word for you, Louise.
Oh, ho, ho.
So she cries. At that point, I have a Dr. David Banner snap.
Yeah.
I like can't stand for this. I go no, and I go no, and I actually genuinely don't remember what I said, but I do remember leaning across the table with my finger pointing right at his face.
You unsheathed the finger.
Totally unsheathed it, like fully out, finger out, interface, pointing and waggling.
Mate.
And I don't remember what I said, but I remember I was so angry and shouting and saying, that's it. But I do remember the aftermath, which was, I finished saying whatever it was I wanted to say, yeah? I was like, and that's enough. But I didn't want the dinner to go on, for it all to be normal again. Do you know what I mean? I didn't want, oh, well, gas to spit. And I said, and that's the end of dinner too. And the lemon tart had only just come out. Literally, it just arrived on the table. My poor brother-in-law, he'd just got it up to his face. And I just cleared the table. I just cleared everybody's plates. Took them out of their hands, put all the lemon tart back onto one big plate, and walked back out of the kitchen. That's the end of dinner. That's it. No one's allowed to go back to it being nice after this, after what you did.
Your children are not at the table at this point.
No, they were young at the time.
So how many adults are sat around?
Six, and one of my wife is crying now.
She's crying, and are you getting the sense that she's crying with joy?
Well, no, there's no joy.
Because she's so proud.
No, she's not proud at this point. We're all thinking. Oh no.
Oh, yeah.
Jennings is just.
This isn't.
It wasn't nice what Mr. Prink said.
Yeah.
But right now, Jennings has just blown it. What he took it too personally. I took it as an attack on my lovely wife, who's amazing, and she didn't deserve that. So I went for him. And cleared the plate so no one else was allowed to have a nice time
no
either.
No lemon tart.
No lemon tart. No tarte au citron for you And
what you should have done is you should have taken all the lemon tart and then eaten it in front of him. This, by the way, this is delicious.
Yum, yum, yum.
Yum.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yum, evil. Yum, yeah.
But yeah, I wish I'd done that. You never do the right thing in the moment. You never even make it, put an eloquent sentence together.
So
I don't.
You are shaking at this point.
Shaking with fury. You know, got that breathing going on like you've been crying, but you haven't been crying. You've just been so furious.
Yeah.
Your voice is all wobbly. And then you go out to the kitchen, you put all the plates down.
And what is Dr. Pringles doing about this?
Silent get up from the table. By the time I came back in, everyone had gone. Yeah, everyone had gone to their rooms. So that wasn't great. And here's the weirdest thing. Immediately afterwards, as I'm sure you can imagine, I'm regretting it like mad.
Mm-hmm.
Even though I think, damn you for saying those cruel things.
Yeah.
And being a bit of a bully in
my
opinion.
That was some righteous indignation on your part.
Well, you don't make your daughter cry and just, you know, anyway. So I'm getting a bit upset. But at the same time, I think, it's only 2 days into an 8-day holiday.
Oh.
That's not great timing.
Where were you again?
Oh, it's Portugal.
Portugal.
There's no escape. It's not like we could pop home. You know everyone's in their respective rooms, either cleaning their teeth or talking to their partners, and you can just feel the... Blimey, what an idiot. He blew up there, didn't he? What about the tart? What happened to the lemon tart? You know, all this sort of stuff.
Yeah, it was delicious.
But the most amazing thing happened. So, obviously, was upset, and she was upset about what he said, but also saying, oh, I wish you hadn't said that. And I completely understood, and I was saying, I am sorry. The first thing I'm going to do in the morning is apologise to everyone.
Yes.
So I was up at some ridiculous hour, because I couldn't sleep. I felt terrible about having... reacted the way I did. At the same time, still like, oh, but he deserved it.
Yeah, and, no roughy that night.
No roughy. No chance of that, yeah. No. So I'm waiting there for everyone to come down, and first of all, Woz's sister comes down the next morning. It's about 6 o'clock or something. We've all got babies at this time. So Rachel, her sister, comes down. I go, oh, Rachel, I'm so sorry about last night. And I could tell she was a bit like, you know, oh, yeah, it's all right, which meant, yeah, you overdid it.
Right.
It was
right.
Her way of saying, yeah, you went too far with the whole clearing of the lemon tart, but let's just pretend that didn't happen.
Uh-huh.
You know, that may not be what she was thinking, but that was the impression. Then her husband came in. I said, listen, John, so sorry about losing it last night. And he's like, and he's chuckling, going, oh, shame, I was getting into that lemon tart there. And he's Irish. That was why I did that voice.
That was accurate.
That was not bad, was it?
No, that
you
was
were,
good.
You were straight back to
I felt like I was in Ireland.
So John's come in.
Yeah.
And he's sort of funny, and he's on my side. He's very sweet and everything. And then Maureen comes downstairs. Maureen's my mother-in-law. And I'm thinking, this is the one. This is the person I'm afraid of, because she's, you know...
She's the matriarch.
She runs the show.
Yep.
So down comes Maureen. And as I'm saying, I literally meet her at the bottom of the staircase. I go, Maureen, I am... Just about last night, I'm so... Before I can finish my sentence, she puts her hand on my arm and says, quietly, I only wish more people would stand up against Mike. And walked off. I was like... That I did not see coming. And she walks off to the kitchen like, that's all I'm going to say about that.
Whoa. You know?
And then Mike comes down.
Yeah.
And he is my best friend in the world.
Shut up.
He is, hello, good morning. I'm staggered. I'm like, good morning, Michael. I'm sorry about last night. Oh, laughs that one off. And then can't say enough about how funny the children are and avoiding all mention of their ludicrous haircuts. He was right, their haircuts were ridiculous. They looked like sort of...
They looked great. They looked like they just stepped out of Vice magazine.
Yeah, but they were only like 2 or 3 years old.
That's ideal for Vice magazine.
But, so it worked out. It did work out. I was pleased afterwards. But, it's amazing how you can suddenly find yourself from nowhere on a holiday... with a lemon tart sitting in front of you, suddenly waggling your finger and screaming at somebody. Two days ago, I was sent a really short email from a guy that lives across the street from me. So I hardly know this guy,
mm-hmm.
but he sent me an email saying, my wife's secretary's daughter would like to do work experience at your company, and these are the 2 weeks she wants to do it in, just in the run-up to Christmas.
Just laying out his
just
terms.
That was it. No, and not even a dear or hello or anything, as if he'd typed it with his thumb in the middle of doing something else.
Uh-huh.
And because I get these things all the time, and I am more than willing to help the enthusiast or the people trying to do their stuff, I will always help if I can, but you've got to at least show a bit of willing.
Yeah.
So I wrote back and said... If
a bit of willy.
Yeah, show a bit of willy.
One or the other.
Just show a bit of willy. No, I wrote back and said, just ask your wife's secretary's daughter to write a letter. Don't expect things to just be handed to you.
Yeah.
That's the worst work experience you could give anyone.
And
do you know what I mean? The job itself might be fine, but you will have learned nothing about how to get it.
Yes, because that's half the struggle, isn't it?
Yeah.
What's your policy on reading people's scripts? I bet a lot of people send their scripts.
Yeah, they do. And again, most people are, again, they're just trying to get started. They don't know how to get going. A brother or something of somebody that worked once at our company is no longer there. Had said, oh, I have this connection to you via someone who used to work at the company you're at. Would you be up for reading some of my scripts? And I wrote back and said, look, I'll do my best, but I'm not the best at giving story advice. I tend to write for myself, and if I give notes, it ends up becoming something I'd do rather than you would do. You know,
right.
I'm not the best at that. But I can always be enthusiastic, and if there's anything I can help with, I will do my best. And they sent me 5 scripts.
Oh.
So I did write back to this person, who's very nice, and I said, look, it's quite a lot.
Being a script reader and giving notes, that's a full-time job that people are employed to do, right?
Yeah, and I don't take the note-giving bit lightly. I think that's quite important, that if you're going to give somebody advice or notes or whatever, and especially if you don't know them, you better get it right. Because you don't want to steer them in the wrong direction. And anyway, so it's quite a tricky one.
But presumably these days as well, it's quite dangerous in the film world to read people's scripts because people litigious.
That's probably a really good point. And I probably shouldn't read them anyway.
Yeah, because they come out a few years down the line and they'll say, hey, I sent you my
script
and
you stole
my idea.
Yeah, I should probably be more sensible. You know what? From this moment on, I'm going to start a new policy.
Well, at least that's an excuse you can give them.
Yeah, it's true. I can say, look, I don't take unsolicited scripts. If you want me to read them, send them via, my agent or something. Yeah, we're coming up with a good plan here. This is good.
Yeah. Come. So what is the best way, though? How did you break in? Did you ever do that? Did you get a leg up from someone you knew?
No, we had no... I grew up in Epping in Essex, and there's no showbiz in my family. I mean, it's a great family, but my dad worked in a bank. The closest we got to being in anything, connected to anything theatrical, was the fact my mum used to design the windows at Dickens and Jones, which used to be on Regent Street. But that was it. My school, I think we were the first GCSE year, and it seemed that along with that, we got this thing called work experience, which up until then, no one had really heard of.
So roughly what date was this?
87, 88.
Uh-huh.
Somebody came into the school and said, right, we're going to do this thing called work experience. And you all had to fill out a questionnaire, which basically involved ticking boxes, things you liked, things you were doing okay at school. And that was given to a computer, apparently. Well, I can't imagine what kind of computer it was, but apparently it went into this giant computer, and the computer went, this is what you can expect to do for the rest of your life. You got this sort of printout you did on like telex paper.
Yeah.
Of careers.
Ingested into the ZX Spectrum.
Exactly. The Spectrum spat out your future, and it was in the form of a grey list of jobs. And I remember getting this list, and everyone was excited because the computer's given us a list of things that we can do with our lives. And it came back, and it was the most depressing list of my life. Only because nothing that I wanted to do was on that list.
Yeah.
Not even close. It wasn't even like, oh, well, that could lead to a good thing. It was rubbish. Anyway, so you had to take that list to the careers advisor teacher person. I don't know who she was.
The Korean advice teacher.
She was Korean. And and she said, all right, well, we looked at your thing here, and as you like drawing so much, what about the town council planning office where they do a lot of drawing?
Hey.
And you could help with the photocopies that they do there.
I'm drawing in the town council planning office.
Exactly. It was like a good time. Well, it's very hard. I mean, it was a new system, and also... what do you do with
That's perfectly decent job, but maybe not the most exciting.
No, so I went home that night and I was all cheesed off. And my dad came home from work and he's sitting at the table. He goes, what's up with you? Ah, I've got careers advice thing. I'm going to work in the town council offices for 3 weeks. If they can get me a job there, if they can get me. And he's like, oh, well, what do you want to do? And I said, well, I'd like to be a rock star. I genuinely said that I'd like to be in a band or something.
Were you not embarrassed to say that?
No, I just was like, well, that's what I'd like to do. And he goes, he sort of laughs. He goes, yeah, well, you can't do that. but you could.
Good for you for saying.
But he did go. He goes. But maybe we could write to one of those recording studios. You know where they actually record the songs. Maybe you could do some work there. And the whole time I'm thinking, nah, it's never going to happen.
Good for your dad.
So my dad goes, come on, let's write a letter. And he made me write this letter out 3 or 4 times because my spelling was always quite bad and my handwriting was wonky as hell. So he made me write this thing over and over again until it was really nice. And we sent out 50 copies.
And you were excited, though. You were up for this plan.
I was really up for it because dad has an infectious enthusiasm. Once he's got the bit between his teeth, you're off. It's happening. And back come 50 rejection letters. So that was a great first lesson.
Are you bummed out at that point?
Yeah, of course. I was thinking, that's that done. And dad goes, no, there's one here that was quite nice. They said no, but they've also given you a list of other places you can consider. That's the weak one. Hit them again. So we write another letter. Again, I'm sort of rushing it a bit and he makes me rewrite the thing. Mm-hmm. And again, a rejection comes back. At this point, I do give up and feel really just cheesed off. And apparently what my dad did then was, at his lunch break, he rang up the head of the personnel department at this recording studio and said, look, he is a dog's body. Just take him on for a couple of days. If it's a problem, send him home. But otherwise, you've got free labour for 3 weeks. He'll be great. That's it. And the woman just gave in to him, said, all right, OK, send him up. So dad comes home and goes, you're starting work at CBS Recording Studios.
Whoa.
Next week. Better get you a travel card. So I was delighted. And CBS was, this is before it was bought by Sony. And it was on, I think, Great Titchfield Street. I might be wrong about that. But it was a spectacular recording studio. It wasn't just any old recording studio. And you had bands like, what do we have coming in? Well, George Michael would come in and do a remix of one of his tracks. I remember Junior, Pepsi and Shirley.
Junior.
Junior.
My mama used to say.
Yeah, he was so nice. Man. Pepsi and Shirley came in and I really liked them.
They were in Wham, weren't they?
They were the backing singers in Wham.
Right.
Yeah, they were the girls with the top knots. But when you're 15 and up to that point, you just assume that the entire entertainment industry, the thing you're most obsessed with, is just done by other people, not people like you. It's just other people that do that. And then suddenly you're in it. Even at a super low coffee making level, you realise that everyone there is just a regular person and they just got into it, A, because they loved it, and B, they just sort of kept on banging on the door.
And so you had a good, positive attitude.
Yeah, I was the sparky guy.
You weren't like sitting around and sighing whenever they asked you to go out and buy some tea bags.
No, I honestly felt like it was a gift to be there. I was almost, in fact, I was almost probably a bit too cautious. I would stay out of everyone's way and make the coffee and then quickly leave the room.
Yeah.
You know, like, I just felt like, the whole time I really shouldn't be here. I remember this one guy who's probably a booking agent or somebody who worked in one of the offices upstairs, and he saw me go past. He goes, oi, come here, listen to this. And it was the new Smiths song. I can't remember which one it was, but I know it was the Smiths. He goes, listen to this. And he presses play on a tape recorder and he plays a Smiths song,
full blast.
And he goes, they're the best band in the world, aren't they? And I go, I don't really know the Smiths. He goes, what do you mean you don't know the Smiths? You've got to know the Smiths. Even old people like the Smiths. I remember him saying that. And it was just amazing to go home thinking, that's what these people do all day long. People that absolutely loved what they were doing.
Yeah.
And so I didn't end up going into the music business, but it did make me think you should definitely have a shot at doing the thing you like doing.
Yes.
And not necessarily take that piece of paper you got given too seriously. You know, that was quite a downer, getting that bit of paper.
Yeah.
And I think it's probably the same for a lot of people.
Getting the bit of paper that said,
yeah, aim low.
Here's the jobs, right,
aim low. You know,
don't get your hopes up. Yeah. If you're lucky, it's the town council planning office for you. I always find on sets, I mean, I'm not on film and TV sets very often at all, but the times that I have been, I'm always impressed by the sparky AD or the runner who's just totally on it, you know?
Yeah.
It's so easy to stand out
in
those situations.
Oh, my God,
but, you know, and that doesn't mean to say that you can't screw up every now and again quite massively. But if you've got
an
attitude...
No one cares if you've got the right attitude.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If you're just like, if you're clearly on it and want to do a good job, that is so valuable. And yet there are always people on these, you know, you're in Pinewood or something, and there's some runner who's like, everything's a drag.
Yeah.
And oh, do I have to? And it's like, yeah. Oh my God. And you're like, man, there's so many other people that would love that.
I think that those people tend to be the ones that got there too easily.
Right.
Like you say, I mean, we had someone once give us a CV that was a, it was like a colour swatch that you would get from a paint shop, uh-huh. you know, when you're choosing your wall colours. And it was various shades of brown, starting with very, very light through to deep, dark brown. And next to it had the names like, had names like...
it's a code brown.
Weak, builders. It was basically different types of tea. And basically, the CV was on the back, you know, what this guy had done. And just, by the way, I make great tea, so just tick the colour you like, and I'll make sure your tea comes to you that colour, every, you know, that, that strength every time.
Oh.
And on films, film sets kind of run on tea.
Yeah.
And even though it was just a bit of a laugh, it was such a sweet, clever little thing to do. And the effort that had been made meant that that guy just went straight to the top of the pile.
Yeah.
And it's amazing to me now how many people that were runners or assistants on our sets to begin with are now not only, you know, the top of their game, but producing big movies now and... You know, really, really very successful in their field.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's lovely. It's great when the good guys win.
We're moving from one subject to a different one. This is a conversation that we're having, talking fun.
You're the first guest on the podcast to actually be in my sound booth.
It's really nice being in here. And I have to say, I think the podcast is a smash. And I'm not just saying that because I'm sitting in front of you. I think quite a lot of our friendship... has been, you know, backing each other up when things are down or like encouraging each other when we're getting started on something. And definitely as your pal now, I would say keep going. You know, don't take any criticism too much. Because I know, there's a lot of feedback. You get a lot of feedback. Whatever
did you,
you do.
Hear me ranting at the about the guy that sent me a message the other day?
Yeah, yeah. And automatically I want to run to your rescue and go, don't worry about it. It's fine. Ignore
Were
it.
Were you thinking, don't talk about that?
Not don't talk about it. Because I think it's funny that you talked about it. And I John was very funny on that subject as well. But I'm terribly protective of you. Because I know you'll read that feedback and you'll
squirmy mind.
You'll go there, you know, and it's one of the good things that you do is you take on board what people are saying and you know, try and adapt or like take it on board. But sometimes I want to just bowl in and say, stop reading it. Don't listen to them. Keep going.
And what do you like then on the criticism front?
I mean, obviously the first film I did, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, I had the rough with the smooth there because we had lots of people that loved it and still send messages and things. And other people, the one guy wrote like a 10,000 word essay. I'm not exaggerating. Apparently a 10,000 word essay on why it was so bad. And so that was actually, it was brilliant to start with that in many ways because that sort of taught you everything you need to know about how to handle opinions and which ones matter and which ones don't. So I feel pretty robust because, you know, the next thing we do is going to be launched in quite a big way and I'll be judged, you know, in accordingly. But I feel very happy about it all. But and the nice thing about animation is you really do, or well, there's millions of things that are nice about it, but one of my favourite things is the fact that you get to press every button.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I loved about films like Toy Story or Finding Nemo was the fact that you could have something really funny, really inventive, moving and everything. It could really be everything.
Man, I remember the first time I saw Toy Story, me and Joe went to see it, and it was one of those moments. When I was talking to Leanne LaHavis in the...
I love that podcast.
Early on, and we were talking about Prince, and I was saying to her that one of those moments that I had where you just think, oh, this is a thing. I'm witnessing something special and... revolutionary was when I saw the video for Alphabet Street.
Yeah, I remember that.
For the first time. And I was like, oh my God, this is special. And then when me and Joe went to see Toy Story, I remember having that feeling as well. It's like, oh, okay, everything's...
That's it.
Something's changed.
You start. I mean, I was with you when you were talking about Prince with Leanne LaHavis. I was reminded of the fact that I was such a huge Prince fan that I was part of the Prince fan club. So much so that I know for a fact that if you freeze frame some of that Alphabet Street video, you can see a little message from Prince that says, don't buy the Black Album, I'm sorry.
Shut up, is that true?
That's absolutely true, yeah. That's how deep I was into Prince. I went to his gigs, I caught his towel, and I've still got it, and it's got brown foundation makeup. there's like a smear. It looks disgusting because obviously it looks like he's wiped his bottom. But it's but I kept it all the same. But it's actually just like a
have you still got that then?
Yeah. Not around. I think, you know what? You know I stored a load of stuff in your barns?
Yeah.
It's in one of those boxes in your barns.
I'm going to rifle through.
You should have a rifle through. But make sure it's the Prince towel and not the other towels.
Wow, that's good. You should have that under a glass jar. You know, Marc Maron has President the cup that President Obama drank from.
Oh, I'd do the same.
When he was on the podcast, the WTF podcast, he's now got Obama's cup under a glass jar.
Oh, I would do the same thing. I really would. If it was Prince, not many other people I would do that for. Yeah.
Well, you see, if I do this podcast long enough and get enough respect,
yeah,
I'm going to get David Cameron in because that's
Cameroni.
Everyone will be so excited.
Yeah, so will he.
Yay! Buckles has got David Cameron. Yeah. I'm so happy for
him. It's so funny when you think about the English equivalent of what Marc Maron's done. You know, he gets Obama in. Obama walks in and he's all fabulous. Could you imagine Cameron coming in here?
Cameron comes in. We have a light, silly chat. Then he sticks a private part of his anatomy in a coffee cup. And I keep that under a glass jar for the rest of my life, showing it off to people. So your children are going to be excited seeing your movie.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? They're going to grow up thinking that this is a normal job, whereas I grew up thinking this was an extraordinary job to have. You know, you didn't think, you know, someone working in the movie business was an ordinary thing. But yeah, they're even going to play little parts in the film.
Hmm.
They're little voice parts. Not big ones, but loud ones.
That's great.
Yeah.
What were their favourite animated films when they were little?
Well, when they were smaller, definitely Toy Stories. All the Toy Story movies. I remember taking Oscar and the kids to see Toy Story 3 and Oscar just sobbing through the end.
Toy Story 3, and I think I have, again, spoken about this before, but Toy Story 3 has that scene where they all believe that they're going to die.
Yes.
And they're sat there and they're going towards a furnace, aren't they?
Yeah, the flames of hell. They're going to be engulfed by the flames of hell.
And they hold hands and they look at each other and in that moment it is understood that
this is it.
Yeah. They've come to the end of their lives.
It's amazing.
And it's really extraordinary. It's like just being punched in the chest.
Well, what's lovely
to see it in a children's film, and also to really have that kind of terror and then a sort of peaceful
acceptance.
Well,
it was the fact that Woody's scrambling. He's desperately trying to sort of find a way out still. But when he looks up at the others, he sees them all looking at him with these sort of solemn expression on their faces, like, just stop, Woody, just stop. And he looks at them like, no, you can't give up now. And then they take his hand and then they all hold hands together. And that they even have like the sort of bell ringing, don't they? In the score, isn't it going like, dong, dong. And then they're holding each other's hands and closing their eyes and bracing themselves for the end of their lives. And it's the most unbelievable thing in the world. And if ultimately you're leading up to one of the best reveals ever, which is that the Claw comes back.
Right.
And it's operated by those three little guys that were saved by the Claw, or two little guys. The Claw, I mean, what? That's just so brilliant. That is next level brilliance. And you know, and the fact that all my children respond to that and I respond to that in the same way makes me so happy. It's so lovely to be able to share a moment. Now, of course, they receive all those signals on a slightly different level. They haven't lived, you know, they're not 43 years old and have seen as much as I have, but still they just feel it. It resonates in a way. And that's so lovely to share with your children.
And then in Toy Story 2 as well, you've got that song.
Oh, that kills me. God. What, Jessie's song?
I mean,
she loved me. Yeah.
I can't actually speak about it.
No!
Because it's one of the things that actually just always makes me cry.
Yeah, it does. And it's weird. I don't know if you find this, but the older I get, the harder it is to stop myself.
If I watched it now, I would start crying.
Yeah.
And I think it works on so many levels. It's like, so it's it's this Jessie doll, and she used to belong to a little girl, and the little girl has discarded her for another toy, right?
Yeah.
Same sort of thing as in Toy Story 1. But she sings this song, And it works as a kind of lesbian love song as well.
Wow, I never thought of it in that way, but the fact that it's so from the heart and so
yeah, but deep, it works in every way. But I think you can read it as a straightforward gay song about having your heart broken.
Yeah,
and it works completely on that level.
Well, that's Randy Newman's genius as well, because even though the idea and that point in the story is a great beat of the story, it's a fantastic beat to have. But he...
I may be reading too much into
it. No. Well, you may have done. But the fact is that it's so, I mean, so eloquent. And then, what's her name? That's a singer called Sarah something. Anyway, it's, you know, when somebody loved me, everything was beautiful, you know. And you're going to have that all taken away by the end of it. And that this little toy is now phobic, is suffering from anxiety based on that separation. She's still traumatized by that. And that's massive.
Amazing. And it works. It works, though, as a song of heartbreak from the point of view of a child and its parent.
Yeah.
And also the other way around, a parent losing touch with its child.
Yeah.
And what it's like to be a parent and not always be able to have your children close to you, or God forbid, lose them altogether, you know.
Yeah, them not need you anymore.
Yeah.
That idea of, you know, she's just kind of let go of. Not thrown away in an angry way. It's just left by the side of the road.
Yes.
And she's going to live her life. And it's inevitable. It's not like a shocking surprise how terrible. It's like, no, that's what happens. And that's profound on so many levels. You almost don't know what's going on with your brain when you're watching that for the first time. You're like, help!
This is an advert for Squarespace.
Hey guys, it's Broshak with me, Paul Broshak. We got Mike here. We're going to talk about his new MMA comedy special. We're going to talk about his view counts, and we're going to talk about conspiracy theories. What's up, Mike?
Hello, Paul.
Hey, brother.
I'm fine, thank you. I don't want to talk about any of those things anymore.
You don't?
No. I want to talk about... I built a website, Paul.
All right. Stream some fights, settle some beefs, stick it to the elites, that kind of thing.
No. It's mainly dog pictures, Paul. And I did it on Squarespace. Have you heard of Squarespace? I went to squarespace.com/Buxton and I did a free trial. And I tried some of the beautiful templates, Paul, and I typed things in. I dragged in pictures of the dogs. And before I knew it, I had a website, Paul. So I bought it and I've made some very sweet dog t-shirts and I sell those on the shop on the website.
Uh-huh. But do you still fight and stuff?
A little bit, but not really. Oh, and Paul, I wanted to tell you that when it comes time to buy your website or domain on Squarespace, if you use the offer code Buxton, you save 10%. Paul.
Thanks, Mike. Where'd you do that free trial?
Squarespace.com/Buxton.
And how sweet were the dogs?
Very.
Well, that's pretty much it for the podcast this week. Thanks very much indeed to Garth Jennings. I'm sure Garth will be popping up in future episodes of this podcast. I don't exactly know how things are going to go with the podcast at the moment. I am spending a lot of time on it, and I do have other professional and personal commitments that I should probably spend a little bit more time on than I have been. Maybe. I mean, this podcast is now hosted on the Acast platform currently, and one of the reasons I went and joined Acast was to see if they might give me a bit more organizational support. Maybe further down the line, find me a sponsor, and then I could afford to pay a producer and just tighten up the efficiency of the whole podcast operation. Get some different guests, a wider variety of guests, that kind of thing. So that would be good, wouldn't it? In the meantime, I'm chungling along on my own. Chungling? What's chungling? Maybe Alexa chungles, but I'm not going to start chungling. I'm just carrying on my own. And you can find out more about this podcast, a little bit more. I do a blog post about it every week, which sometimes contains links to some of the things I've been talking about with my guest.
I've got a blog. Rudy, Rudy, Spooty, Rudy, blog. I've got a blog. Here's the address. It's adam-buxton.co.uk. So check it out.
There you go. And the blog is a good place to leave comments about the podcast or anything else, if you wish.
You can also leave comments on my SoundCloud page or get in touch with me on Twitter. At Adam Buxton is my handle. Just looking at my blog now, in fact, approving a few comments. Here's one that's just come in. This is real. Naturally, like your website, but you have to take a look at the spelling on several of your posts. Several of them are rife with spelling issues. And I, in finding it very bothersome to inform you the reality, then again, I will definitely come again. I think maybe that's spam. But still, nice comment. So what else can I tell you before I wrap up this week's podcast? There won't be a contrived comedy bit at the end of the podcast this week. But by way of apology for that, here's a little insight into my exciting professional life. Yesterday, I got an email from my agent about an advert. And I've been approached to be in on screen in an advert like... You know, I do the occasional voiceover for adverts, as I was saying to Rob Brydon last week. But I very seldom appear on screen in them. I always feel like that's more of a commitment. You're you as you endorsing a product rather than just being an actor providing a voiceover for an ad. That's the way I think about it anyway. So you have to consider those things a lot more carefully. The money's a lot bigger when that's the situation. So that's obviously tempting. But here is the key line in the email that made up my mind for me. And it says, "We've done these commercials in several different countries now, and most of the time, we've gone for someone quite young and good-looking. So, as much as I like Adam and his enormous beard, it will be a slightly different approach we take if we were to use him." Smiley emoticon. That's nice that he had the smiley emoticon there at the end. But who knows, maybe in 6 months... you'll be watching TV and the ads will come on and one of them will have an old, ugly guy with a giant beard on it and you'll know that Buckles has bought himself a gold swimming pool. Please take care. I love you. Bye!